Well, thanks very much. I'm really conscious of the fact that I've just spent the last couple of hours sitting out in the sunshine and becoming more and more relaxed, and suddenly realise I've got to put my brain into gear and talk about serious things again. But I'm happy to do that, and I'm very grateful that the room is a full room, and I think it indicates the level of concern that there is within the Christian community for the issue of refugees and asylum seekers. As has been said, I work for an organisation, I'm the director of an organisation which for 20 years now, we're 10 years younger than 10 years younger than Greenbelt, for 20 years has been working to advance the human rights and social justice of people displaced by war and conflict, and very much engaging with people at local level. In our early days, it was with people from Namibia, and one of our former members, who was then a Namibian refugee, has just been appointed as the Commissioner for Social Affairs at the African Union. Another of our former members is the Minister of Labour in Chile. So situations do change as the years go by and people do go home. But it's very good for us now to be engaged with what are increasingly serious issues in UK politics, the issue of asylum, which regularly grabs the headlines. I'll talk for a while and then, you know, you can fire away with questions or comments. That would be very good. And I've called my seminar today Asylum, an Overstated Case or a Deepening Crisis. And sometimes I just sit in my office and think, what on earth are people making the fuss about? This is an overstated case, and yet it is still a deepening crisis. Examine that. I think it was last week, I can't remember which day it was, the Daily Star ran the front page headline, Asylum Seekers Eat Our Donkeys. You do then begin to realise that the popular press, the right-wing press, has the ability and the capacity to pour venom, racist venom, out into the system of the minds and the conscience of this country by using the term asylum seeker rather than using the word black. And I think all of us, with a conscience, have to grapple with the question. What are the issues? What's the truth behind those nasty headlines? I'm going to spend a bit of time just unpacking some of the mythology. Some of you may be very familiar with all of this, but nevertheless, the fact that the lies are told again and again and again means that we have again and again and again just to state the facts. Despite the deepening crisis of poverty, war, conflict, and despite the incredible increase in the capacity of people to move from one country to another, and let's face it, cheap airfares, you know, have got something to do with this situation, still only 3% of the world's population actually are on the move. Only 3% of the world's population have moved from one country to another. But that is still 168 million people, many of whom will have moved for the sake of moving because they want to. And there's nothing wrong. In fact, there's everything good about people choosing to move from one place to another. Others will be displaced within their own countries, and some will have been forced displaced people from one country to another. The United Kingdom is the second largest recipient of asylum seekers in the European Union, but it is the eighth if you present the statistics in terms of per head of population. So we are not by any means the leading country in Europe for the receipt of refugees and asylum seekers. And in fact, and this is the most important statistic of all, 3/4 of the world's refugees are in the developing world. The majority of refugees simply move to the neighbouring country. The majority of refugees are not in the Western world. And the Western world is just spending more and more and more money to keep people out. The numbers, and I don't want to just go on about numbers, but just at a very crude level, the numbers indicate that the situation is manageable, that the numbers of people moving from place to place remains manageable. So are these people, and that's how it's always phrased, isn't it, these people, are these people a drain on the resources of this desperately overcrowded island? You know this concept that some people have, that Britain will sink into the ocean if one more foot steps upon it. Well, if there were no net inward migration into this country over the next 25 years, the number of 16 to 64-year-olds would drop by 2 million, whilst at the same time, the number of people over 65 would rise by 3 million. So, we can deduce, and it isn't weird left-wing liberals like myself who argue this. The European Union is very clear about it. We need inward migration. And the government, God bless them, the government is planning for inward migration. Government departments have serious meetings to discuss the housing of inward migrants. They have serious meetings to plan the number of people they need. And they are increasing the number of visas that they make available to skilled personnel because we need those skilled personnel. So whilst the government is condoning or actually colluding, is the better word, with the right-wing press and making sure that it doesn't fall foul of the Daily Mail readership as if they voted for them anyway, they are themselves planning for inward migration in order to maintain the social systems of this country and to maintain the economic order. And that is more serious in some parts of the country than others, and in Scotland it is a very, very serious problem. I think Scotland's depopulation is falling and falling, and because of outward migration from Scotland, and they are urgently needing. And if you look at the Scottish Executive, they really do have a very positive approach to the whole dispersal of asylum seekers to Scotland for their own reasons. And of course, if you, as I've said, people move from one neighbouring country to another in the developing world, the people who are likely to make it to Europe and the Western world, and this is a problem for people who are working in the area of refugees and asylum seekers, the people who are likely to move from the south to the north are the people with the skills, the people who might have studied in university here, the people who might have some money to quickly pay for an airfare, the people who might have relatives here who can send the airfare and apply for family reunion or whatever. So we are in receipt in our country of people with high-level skills. The project I work in has done a small amount of work just with refugee overseas qualified nurses. And I think we're well on the way to providing almost 100 nurses for our local health service by providing just a specialised training course which equips them with the English and knowledge of the NHS and so on that they need. So useful skills that we need. The other myth, of course, is that people are bogus. We like the genuine refugees, but we don't like, you know, the ungenuine. We don't like the bogus refugees, the ones who are trying it on. Well, you only need to list the countries from which people come to know that the situation is more complex than that. If people are coming from Afghanistan, you can understand. If they're coming from Iraq, you can understand. From Somalia, you can understand. From Sri Lanka, from Turkey, from Iran, from the former Republic of Yugoslavia. The simple fact is that it is war that is causing asylum. It gets messed up. It gets messed up because the United Nations Convention makes it very clear that a refugee is somebody with a legitimate, who is persecuted because of their race, their gender, their ethnicity, their political beliefs, their faith, and so on. So if someone to be designated a genuine refugee must simply know, must be able to prove that they individually, they by their name were persecuted. That's the legal definition. If you're part of a conflict zone and you're part of a general mass of people who are facing persecution, who are living day by day in the context and the reality of violence, then officially you are not genuine. But of course, fair-minded people must understand that the reality, the day-by-day grind of situations like a country like Colombia, where violence is endemic, and you know, I've been in Colombia many times and seen day-to-day violence. It's just there in front of you in the street. And if that grinds you down and you decide to move, then you are not called genuine. But you and I might well want to do the same if we were in that situation. And of course, the whole engagement of organized crime in the trafficking of people makes it even more complicated still. And it does all get messed up and mixed up. But I'll say something about that a bit later on. Another part, of course, of the overstated case is, and you'll love this one, Britain has a noble tradition of welcoming refugees. We have a noble tradition. Well, if you look at the Daily Mail for the last, 100 years, the headlines were the same when the Russians, Jews were coming from the programs in the early, 1900s. The headlines were the same when people were fleeing Germany in the 1930s. And they are the same today. That noble tradition has actually always been a tradition of xenophobia and people of goodwill acting with good faith. What we see today is the tradition that we've always had, a conflict between the xenophobes and the people of goodwill who recognize and understand. Okay. I believe it's an overstated case. It's a reality. It's part and parcel of the world that we live in. If Mr. Blair wishes our economy to have armaments, at the core, if Mr. Blair wants to support the policies of President Bush, and if he wants to take the country to war whilst bypassing the legitimate international mechanisms and use the method of bombs rather than strengthening international law, then there will be people displaced by war and conflict. It's an inevitable consequence. What is it that they use? The official spokespersons of the government talk about collateral damage. So it was so nice when they talked about, they just sort of talked about the war, what was going to happen in Iraq, and then there would be some collateral damage, but don't worry. Grants have been made to humanitarian organizations to deal with the collateral damage. Well, the collateral damage are people. They're people. And they have lives and stories and families and relationships. And we have no... And we should not be surprised if people come here when we send our bombs over there. It's just a basic equation. But still, I think the numbers are small. So what is the deepening crisis? And I think I'm just beginning to touch on what I think the deepening crisis is. The deepening crisis is the international order. That we must stop separating our issues. You know, we have trade, justice, debt, all of that stuff going on here. And then there's asylum over there. There's the peace tent over there. There's ecology somewhere else. All of these issues are kind of packaged and separated. But in reality, they interlock, they interrelate. And the asylum issue is normally seen as a rather local problem. A group of people coming into a town when they weren't there before. But actually the refugee asylum question is part and parcel of the whole issues of international security, international conflict, arms trades, you know, ecology, and so on and so on. All of these things impact upon each other. And we must fear. I mean, I think the government is in a mess in relationship to asylum policy, has been for a long time. But it's a small mess in comparison to the big mess, which is to fail to have an interconnected foreign policy and development policy. You know, I would just love that question of asylum to be taken out of the Home Office and put it somewhere in international development where it belongs. It's part and parcel of all of that, you see. But there is a crisis of government policy. You know, they're so sweet, aren't they, I mean, the government? You know, they think of a policy, they're going to get tough. It doesn't work. So they get tougher. And they're ever so macho about it all, aren't they? You know, they're always going to get tougher. We're going to keep these people out. We're going to put them in prison. And they put them in prison. And they put children in prison. So I voted Labour. I'm ashamed to say I voted Labour not because I wanted children kept in prison in the United Kingdom. But that's what's happening in Scotland. And there are two consequences of the failure of the government to manage the entry of asylum seekers. One is it just keeps costing more and more money. I think one of the newspapers today had the headline about something about asylum fat cats, and they are there. You know, there are asylum fat cats. There are people who make profit out of homelessness, just as there are people out of asylum seekers, as there's always been people who made profit out of homelessness. The 25 richest countries of the world, this country included, are tripling and quadrupling the amount of money they spend keeping people out. I mean, I haven't got the figures. I wish I'd brought them. But the amount of money we spend, you know, well over £1 billion on keeping asylum seekers out compared to the small amount of money that we contribute as a country to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, which is dealing with that 3/4 of the world's refugee population in refugee camps in the developing world. Now, there is some shift in the government thinking around that, and its relationship with the United Nations High Commission is growing. As you know, the UNHCR are actually processing now some of the applicants from Ghana. Nevertheless, money is wasted on a huge scale, and actually people are quite right to criticise the government for the amount of money it's spending on asylum seekers, because that money is wasted money on poor quality accommodation, which is actually not well serving the people. The real investment needs to be in international, you know, conflict resolution. It needs to be invested in the places where people are coming from. Countries like Liberia and the conflict should never have been ignored for as long as it has been ignored. And we need a much more efficient, quick process rather than keeping people waiting for a long period of time, although things are speeding up. But the other problem of these tough measures is that actually it's opened the door for organized crime. The fact that there are no legitimate routes into the country and that all the doors, and they see the country like a colander, you know, they keep popping up the holes and in there. Because you keep blocking up the holes, then actually you create a market for organized crime. And the people who've organized gun smuggling and drugs trafficking now are trafficking people. And that is going to be a very, very hard thing to stop. And it's the government's fault. They'll spend infinitely more amount of money on international policing arrangements to try and stop that, when actually they could simply have created an easier route for people, a fairer route for people. And the third consequences of the mishandling of the system has been racism at local level. And I think there may be people here who are, you know, aware in their own context, their own situations, of racism arising because the government has failed to adjust its policies between, you know, community cohesion and asylum seekers and this whole thing of unplanned dispersal. So where there are, you know, good things happening, and I know the towns like Leicester, where they've taken quite serious consideration and thoughtful consideration, Glasgow, where some quite interesting things are going on, in a town like Stoke-on-Trent, which very nearly elected anybody from Stoke-on-Trent here? Yeah. You know the situation there, which is absolutely a situation where the government's community cohesion agenda has, and, you know, regeneration agenda has been actually undermined by the Home Office giving, you know, contracts to private developers, you know, for the National Asylum Support Service. So local problems have arisen, and they're not by any means across the country, but there's some local situations which have arisen which have been extremely problematic, and the local, you know, local context have had to pick that up. I just don't want to keep talking because I feel that, you know, I'm sure there's so many people here who've probably got experiences and interesting situations that they'd want to share with me. But I would like to reflect on this as a Christian, and reflect on this in terms of how we as church people respond pastorally and politically. Not that pastoral and political in any sense are separate things, but we do have to focus on them in both ways. And I think there's two sides to it. The first is to argue for and to try and understand what is a common sense framework for looking at the issues. What is the framework? What are the spectacles that we need to wear, you know, in critically examining proposals, suggestions, and in critically working for justice for refugees? Well, the first I've already sort of talked about, and it is very, very important that to campaign for the end of armament sales is to campaign for refugees. To campaign for international development, to campaign for fair trade, is also to campaign for refugees. Ultimately, it's the most important thing to campaign for, because actually people for the most part, don't want to move. I believe if people want to move, they should move. But if people don't want to move, they shouldn't have to. And that's simply the case, that most people don't want to move. So our first job is to create, is to work for, as we do, justice in the international system, and not forget that that is part and parcel of the response to refugees and asylum seekers. The next thing, I think, is to think about international justice. It was the really hard question that was posed in advance of the Iraq War. How do you, you know, justify going in and killing innocent people? But at the same time, the argument was put back, how do you justify the maintenance of a repressive regime? And I think we have to focus very hard on how the international community responds to repression. And that is extremely important because, as I indicated earlier, refugees are not just piling in from everywhere. They're coming from conflict situations. They're coming from local conflict situations. And therefore, we have to work and focus on those. We have to think about peacemaking, peacekeeping, peace building, reconciliation, development. For some years, the organization I work for has had a relationship with Liberia. We have a sort of partnership with a small organization called the National Human Rights. I say small. It's tiny in terms of its budget and so on, but it's probably, you know, the, one of the most important organizations of civil society. It includes the Catholic Justice and Peace Group and the Methodist Church Human Rights Monitor Group and so on. The National Human Rights Center of Liberia, you know, has been struggling away in that awful situation, whereas the rest of the world has been turning its eyes away. Only when the, you know, the whole situation completely implodes, then do television cameras, you know, point there. And there are so many situations in the world which go neglected because they are apparently, you know, unresolvable. The Sudan, you know, the situation. I saw some things here about northern Uganda and so on. Those kind of situations are the ones that we can focus in upon and actually keep them in the public eye. And I hope that the major NGOs as well hear that message, you know, that they do make the link, and they make the link between those issues, so that those of us who are working around the question of refugees and asylum seekers are not seen as different from those who are working on trade, justice, and peace and reconciliation and other issues. The next part of the common framework, I think, and this is very important for NGOs as well, is not to be greedy with the skills. That it's too easy for us to argue, look, these people are all right because they're clever. You know, it's all right because there's some doctors amongst them. It's all right because they're nurses or whatever. When actually, you know, there are 20,000 Africans with PhDs, according to UNESCO, live outside of Africa, in exile, in the diaspora. There is a brain drain from the South. There is a recruiting process going on, not just because of refugees, but other recruiting processes, which is further inhibiting the development process. So we have to try and be much more clever about the way in which skills are circulate between the North and the South. We need those skills. We need to return the skills. And we have to think not just in terms of we have to think in terms of the way in which we strategize around development issues in relationship to the South, so that when we're looking at organizations like Christian Aid and so on, we want to know how many of the refugee skills are being employed. When we look at our churches, talk about the NHS if we want. We can talk about other big public institutions. But we want to know how many of the skills of the refugees are being employed within our churches. I mean, I know several ordained ministers who are refugees. One led the service in my church yesterday, but normally in the week he's packing shelves in Tesco's because he's not employed in a church. So we need to look at the way in which the skills of the refugees coming into this country can be used within the organisations that we have, but at the same time, not kept here, but returned. Now, that requires some skill and some working out, but I'm sure there are people here in situations and organisations which can think about that. We need to enjoy the company of new people. You know, we need to enjoy being in a multicultural society, and a lot of us do, I know that. We need to thank God that the British identity is changing. You know, I mean, we need to thank God for that and not try and hang on to something that wasn't worth hanging on to. I speak as a Welshman. And we have to think about the process of settlement, which begins on day one, you know. And what the government want is somehow or other this nasty experience of an asylum seeker. They want asylum to be the nastiest experience that you could possibly have. And then, of course, we want to be all multicultural and multiracial, and very, when people have got their status and we know they're genuine, you know, then that's going to be all right. Well, of course, it's in that first crucial stage when a person arriving from a traumatic situation should be helped with the English, should be given the options and the thinking about what work they could be doing, should understand the housing system and all of those kind of things, and be given the personal and the emotional support. That's the time when it is most needed, and we have to focus in, try and get through the government's repressive system and try and get in there to make sure that that is a more positive experience. One thing we do is to have arrangements, harder now with the government's policies, but arrangements where people actually live in the homes of people within the community and have been hosted, you know, in private homes rather than living in some of the awful situations. That's, we're doing that more now with unaccompanied minors leaving care because that's easier. But you know, it's the sort of thing that could have been done more positively by the government, but they were just insisting on these harsh regimes. And we have to recognise that human rights across the world are indivisible. You know, and if children are imprisoned in the UK, we should be deeply ashamed and we should be campaigning for their release. And we have to tackle organised crime. So we need a framework. We need a framework of understanding based in international justice and international law. But as Christians too, there's a theological thing, and I don't think it's the theology of the stranger. I don't think it's about the welcoming of the stranger that is the thing. It's about our common suffering. That amongst refugees are Christians, as I said. You know, I mean, I've already said that within the people I know, there are many people of deep Christian faith. These are my brothers and sisters, they're your brothers and sisters. And if we're part and parcel of the body of Christ, and a part of the body of Christ is suffering, as it is in Sudan, as it is in Pakistan, as it is in Liberia, and so on, if a part of the body of Christ is suffering, then we are suffering too. That is our faith. That's, you know, Pauline, it's biblical, it's just what it means to belong to a community. And too often over the last years, Christians have been abandoned to their fate. Too often, Christians in the north have been part and parcel of a system of continuing the suffering of our fellow brothers and sisters. Too often, we have been Saul of Tarsus, going about the business, the zealous business of persecuting Christians by selling armaments, by tacitly, you know, shoring up repressive regimes, and it's time for a road to Damascus. And then I think, you know, what does Christian neighborliness mean? Because, you know, we're so often faced with these big, big questions, you know, global systems, you know, huge, huge, intractable wars around the world. And we might fall into the trap of feeling powerless. We might, because we don't. Because the counter to it is always the building of community. The counter to the fragmentation of the global, you know, of the global world, village, global world, global village, is the building of community. So if we belong to a world church, we have to know a world church. If we belong to a church that is in suffering, then we have to know that suffering. It isn't enough to know it from magazines and papers. We have to know it through people and relationships and build those relationships with people. And that is the counter. That is the counter to build a new set of networks, unbeknown to those people who are trying to destroy them, to build a new set of networks. And the other thing is our relationship with Islam. Because the mass majority of refugees are Muslim. Some Christian refugees are victims of violence by Muslims. That is true. But the vast majority of the world's refugees are Muslim. And we have to ask ourselves, as Christians, what is our neighborliness to the Muslim? And I think, in some ways, the refugee enables us to have the opportunity to be neighborly to the Muslim. Who is my neighbor? There's enough theology in that word, isn't there? So, the case is overstated. There really aren't hordes of people massing over here going to make the island sink into the ocean. There is, however, a real issue affecting real people. The government policies are a mess. They need not be. But the real answer lies in, you know, the real crisis, the real deepening crisis, which is the crisis of the international order. And what we need is, first of all, common sense. Don't freak out. Just common sense. And secondly, to have a sense of what we have in common as neighbours in this world. Thank you. I guess people might want to shout me down or something.
About 15 minutes.
Sir. 15 minutes, okay. Will you time keep?
Indeed. I think there's a lot of people sitting at the back. I would just say this. There's probably room for maybe four or five, half a dozen people at the front. If anyone would like to come forward now, please do. And please can we keep a route clear to the door because some people want to leave. So if you brought your own chair in, can you just move it forward, please, so we can keep the route clear. Thanks. Sorry, Mom.
Okay.
What should the people of Bicester do now that planning consent has been granted?
I don't know. I've got a friend who lives in Bicester who has worked very hard with a group. Are you from Bicester? No. Is there anybody from Bicester here? Is there anybody from Bicester here? Yes? No? Sort of. Okay. But there was a group that was sort of opposing the thing for good reasons. There was a group that was opposing it for bad reasons, and there was a group who were opposing it for good reasons. What should people do? Sorry, go on.
I can actually give people contact numbers if they'd like to get in touch with either Vista Refugee Support or Sea Life Welfare.
Yeah. I think it is exactly that. It's actually people making sure that there are real contacts, and it's not just about personal contacts and friendliness and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It's also about human rights monitoring, you know, monitoring what is actually going on and making public what is going on. and stories that are heard, making sure that they're told of the way in which, you know, guards in camps actually treating people, how people's languages, you know, are ignored, and all of those kind of things. And to think that we are in monitoring a human rights problem, that's what we're doing, in which there are real people, you know, caught up. And all human rights work is first and foremost casework, relating, trying to, you know, prevent the problems and the issues. And secondly, it's about campaigning and making and exposing the abuses when they occur. Well, I think, first of all, if people are not affirming you for your choice, I think we should, you know. And then, of course, I mean, there's two sides to the NHS. One is the contribution that people are making to the NHS in terms of the workforce. That's the obvious thing, and the potential that they could contribute to the workforce. But the second thing is that the health studies, you know, indicate that actually, for the most part, refugees arrive as, you know, quite healthy people. As I said before, the people who come here tend to be people with more capacity. They tend to be younger people, and they don't come with health problems. But the indicators show that health does deteriorate here as a result of the treatment that they receive. So all these sort of scare stories, you know, around, you know, well, TB particularly is actually something that people quite hear. There is an issue around HIV, which is a very sensitive issue that needs, you know, addressing very, very sensitively. But it is not, you know, as I said, it's another story that could be overstated, you know, to create fear and paranoia when there is no need to do it. It's simply an issue that is perfectly manageable and perfectly, you know, could be dealt with quite sensitively and without huge, huge resources being thrown at it.
Mm. You say that the overstated case that Britain tends to see in the ocean with all the people coming, you know, is quite rightly overstated, except that I'm sure there's a large mass of people in this country that would actually believe that from what they read, mm. you know, in the papers that they read. And I was wondering what role do you see churches and charities, myself as a Christian, have, if any, in actually educating the broad mass of people in our own country who believe that? And won't that actually do a large part helping the issue as a whole?
Yeah. I mean, I've never understood, somebody else here might understand it, I've never understood quite what the agenda of the right-wing press is, you know, on the asylum issue. Certainly, I think they see a weakness in the government's policy and therefore have been, you know, going at it there. But as the government has become under more and more attack under a wider range of issues, you know, when in the early days of the Labour government, it was really the only one that they could sort of get them on, you know. But as it can, this still issue of asylum seekers has still continued, and I don't quite understand why. But they've got an agenda, and they're very powerful, and they're very forceful, which is why I say, I mean, number one, yes, we should challenge, you know, and actually writing letters to the newspapers and so on, particularly local press, because the local press are actually fueling quite a lot of this. I mean, an awful lot of stuff in local situations. And churches locally have got more influence with the local press than they're likely to have with the Daily Mail and so on. They will just twist anything the way they want to twist it. So that's one thing. Yes, challenging the press. But the second is creating alternative media. You know, I mean, that's what churches are. What other organisations, you know, gather once a week, you know, with that number of people in one place to be told things, you know? And it's actually true, I mean, throughout the world, that particularly in repressive and difficult situations, that churches are used in that way. That's where information is shared, and that's where, you know, the challenges really take place. So when I say create a counterculture, create a culture of neighbourliness that is just subverting quietly and, you know, creating more, it's actually worth doing. Because people might suddenly be surprised to find that there isn't this mass of people out there, but there is quite a wanting to get rid of asylum seekers, which there isn't really. But there is this, you know, very clear and together group of people that actually want to say no to the policies. Now, I've done quite a lot of work actually locally with the NHS because there are very real issues, you know, and I think it is it's very, very important to sort of get inside, you know, what is going on. The NHS has its own culture, you know, it has this sort of division between, you know, clinicians and, you know, non-clinical staff and all the rest of it. And people do get quite frightened of multicultural, intercultural work when they have no need to, but they do. So I think there is, you know, there is a need for the NHS to address, you know, the diversity question, you know, very, very thoroughly. Are you in London or? Okay, right. I guess the situation. Yeah, it's quite different then. That's quite different to the situation that we're working in, you know, in Tower Hamlets where we are, where the issue is actually about changing the nature of the workforce so that it is more multilingual.
Yeah. So if you're into a patient, you use the same strategy
exactly
that you've got for anybody, and there are strategies to take, in place, practices to take, rather than actually dividing into race.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but there is a training need, I think, around multicultural. Yeah, and intercultural work in all institutions. You know, and it's a hard one to address. I mean, but it's not hard to address. It's easy to address. It's just getting the will amongst, particularly amongst senior managers, to understand, you know, the need for that, and to be systematic about the way in which that training is developed. You know, yeah. Oh, there's lots.
Yeah. Okay.
Hands everywhere. Do you just want to finish it up? Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, we can't probably go into that one, but it is about building trust. It is about, you know, building mutual understanding. It's about training. It's about awareness. It's a whole set of things that have to be dealt with both personally, interpersonally, but also structurally within the organisation. Yeah. Oh, gosh, I don't know. How do you know? Sorry, yes, go on. Yeah, please. Yes. There's so many issues here. Yeah. Right. Yes. 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 That's an idea. I mean, yeah. Okay, just one more. Oh, yes, okay. I want to say something about the European thing, though. Yes, it's a... Yeah, I just to tidy it all up, finish up. I mean, thank you for that last comment. The police station in Holborn used to have a notice saying Aliens Registration Office, and it was just at the back there. But I think it's helpful, I think, in terms of the biblical concept, but the word itself now perhaps doesn't have the coinage in English that we want. But I think it's absolutely right that this dividing up people up into their legal categories of refugee, asylum seekers, immigrants, and so on does not help actually think about people and their needs and their circumstances and situation. So it is, those words are very unhelpful. It's just that they're used, and you know, you have to engage with the debate with some language. The point about Europe was one I left out, and it is absolutely crucial in terms of campaigning. Most of the legislation really emanates from Europe. And it may well be that a Europe solution and maybe some central process which takes place at a European level may be more beneficial than each national government. But, I mean, there's a debate to be had about that. But Europe is very, very important in terms of setting the agenda. Thank you.
Thanks very much to Vaughan Jones. A couple of things to mention. I'm very pleased to see one or two people proudly wearing their trade jacket.